Welcome to the latest installment of the Science Progress interview series. Science Progress is a magazine about progressive science and technology policy, which connects the work of scientists, technologists, and policymakers working for the common good. In this installment, Jonathan Pfeiffer speaks with cryptographer and security specialist Bruce Schneier about science and national security. Bruce Schneier is the author of several books on cryptography and security and is the founder and chief technology officer of computer security services company BT Counterpane. Previously, Schneier worked at the United States Department of Defense and AT&T Bell Labs.
The National Research Council, which is part of the National Academies, has just released a report which expresses the concern articulated by many people, not the least of whom have included you, that the new national security measures after 9/11 have either been ineffective or have even made us less secure or have stifled good, legitimate activities of science and engineering and other activities which are crucial for our economy. And one of the main concerns of the NRC now is that after 9/11, the federal government has categorized too many scientific research results as sensitive but unclassified. So could you explain what sensitive but unclassified means for scientists or policymakers who may be unfamiliar with the term?
You know, it's kind of a weasel term. In the U.S. government, in the military, there is classified military information, you know, government secrets. And there are levels of classification, confidential, secret, top secret, and then code words above that. And there are special rules for dealing with that information. Sensitive but unclassified is kind of this halfway house between public information and classified information. So it's not really a secret, but someone somewhere doesn't want someone else to know, so it becomes this gray area. The rules are a lot sloppier. There's a lot more leeway, and more, not only in science, but everywhere, information that used to be given to the public as a matter of course becomes sensitive but unclassified. And it could be phone directories. It could be hours of operation of buildings. It could be locations of polling places, which you seems would be public. And also a lot of scientific data, information, knowledge, stuff that is used by the scientific community, used by businesses, used by everybody, gets stuck in this sort of halfway house between secret and open.
Mm-hmm. So this is a form of secrecy.
It's definitely a form of secrecy. Yes. It's a form of secrecy, and it's a form of stifling information sharing. And where it affects scientists is that science thrives on information sharing.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Science works because one person's research becomes another person's footnotes.
You wrote in Beyond Fear that secrecy in science and engineering, quote, stifles the cycle of innovation and invention that fuels the economic engine of the world's open societies, unquote.
And right, well, that's exactly true, right? My research becomes data you use for your research, becomes data someone else uses for their technology, becomes stuff someone else uses for their products. And all of this feeds on each other. Right? Mm-hmm. And our society, our technology, is great because of that openness. Because whatever scientists do, whatever researchers do, becomes fodder for this engine of more research. And when you start cutting off branches, when you start saying, no, that's too sensitive, don't make it public,
mm-hmm.
you're stifling research because now no one else can use that research. Right? Now, no, we can't benefit from that research. And the benefits are often hidden. Right? We don't know which piece of research will fuel the next big advance in computers and medical devices and transportation. We have no idea.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't just say, well, that doesn't have application in anything except, you know, bad things. So we can make it secret. You don't know that. Right? There's a conceit here. Right? The counterargument is going to be, well, if you make this research, let's make this up, into explosives, public, the bad guys will find out about it. Right? But that's true for everything in our society. Everything we do can be used by the good guys and the bad guys, right? We use cars to get around. Bank robbers use cars to drive away. We use telephones. The mafia uses telephones. Right? The reason society works is the good uses outweigh the bad uses. Sure, you can ban telephones. Sure, you can ban automobiles. Sure, you can ban scientific research. But it doesn't help, because the benefits of doing these things, of having these technologies, of making them open and available, greatly outweigh the disadvantages. Right? And that's what we're losing sight of. Right? We're trying to contain certain types of research because of near-term fears, but then we lose all the long-term benefits.
Well, I think the National Research Council is kind of taking that same position or a similar position, and one of the things they're recommending now is the full implementation of NSDD 189, which was Ronald Reagan's order in 1985 to keep unclassified research results open and available to the maximum possible extent. And so I wanted to ask you, are there any concerns that you have about referring now in the world of post 9/11 policymaking to Cold War era policies such as 1S or NSDD 189?
Well, the devil's in the details. If that is a good document, right? If that document really does say that, you know, we should make research open and available, you know, then I don't care when it was written, if it was written 20 years ago or 30 years ago or 50 years ago.
Okay.
I mean, so no, I mean, I have no concern about that. I mean, we'd have to read the details of the document to make sure that there aren't any hidden gotchas, but in general, I think that's fine.
Well, maybe I can kind of turn the question a little bit different. Do you think there are science and security issues that policymakers in 1985 were not able to anticipate?
You know, I think not. I think the rhetoric that 9/11 changed everything is overrated, that the issues of science and openness are just as important now as they were then, that the threats and the risks are just as big or small or whatever then as they are now, that the same philosophy of openness that has served our country for over 200 years should still be in effect. So no, I don't see any change in worldview that would make us have to reassess scientific openness policies from 20, 30 years ago.
Mm-hmm. A lot of scholars of global and international studies will stand up and say that the world is a different place, maybe beyond the issue of security, but you're talking just about the security aspect of this issue, correct?
Yeah. Right. I mean, the world's a different place in that there's a lot more globalization. I mean, you know, one of the things that isn't anticipated is how much of the research has now moved outside the U.S., because of secrecy concerns, because of, you know, weird laws prohibiting certain kinds of research, because of problems with visas. A lot of really good research is now being done in Europe, in Asia, in Australia, in the Middle East, in other countries. So these policies are actually hurting us in ways that'll take us decades to recover, because we're losing the scientific advantage our country had.
Mm-hmm. Well, to the extent that secrecy often makes for bad security policy, what about good security policy? You also said in another quote from Beyond Fear that, quote, each question of publishing has its own trade-off, unquote, meaning that maybe we should take a case-by-case basis for deciding how to regulate security in scientific and engineering publishing. But it seems that the federal government faces a challenge when regulating a broad range of science publishing. What principles should guide policymakers considering the regulation of dual-use research publishing? Are there broad principles or guidelines that...
Well, the first principle is openness should be assumed, that we should strive for openness wherever possible. There are areas of research that are wholly military, right? You know, minefield detection, you know, military missile technology, nuclear weapons technology. I mean, there are specific technologies that are wholly military, and it makes sense that parts of that research should be classified. It should be kept secret. And the stuff on the edges, you know, research into nuclear power, which has both commercial and military applications, should be judged on a case-by-case basis with the bias towards making things open.
Okay.
So, you know, it's only a big problem if you try to classify broad swaths of research. But if you realize the things that should be kept secret are actually very narrow, then it becomes a much easier problem.
I see. Well, when I listen to these discussions about science and security, it seems that there's an assumption that happens where we think that the science community and the security community are divided by their goals. We think that the science community generally wants everything to be open so that collaboration can flourish. But the security community is keen to restrict publishing and even to restrict actual research when it could make terrorism more effective. Is that a valid assumption for policymakers?
Yeah, that's probably true. You know, most security people have a fetish for secrecy, that there is this belief that secrecy will make them safer. Right? It's nonsense. It makes no sense. It's not the way to play the game. But yeah, you'll find that those in security, especially in national security, want to make everything secret in the thought that it'll make us safer. And science is about openness. You know, science is all about publishing. If you do the research, you don't publish, you might as well have not bothered to do the research. Right? You haven't increased the wealth of human knowledge if you don't publish.
So if we have this division of goals between scientists and security people, how effective and constructive do you think right now is the dialogue between these communities?
Yeah, the dialogue's pretty terrible. I mean, right now, especially in politics, security is winning. You know, whether it's right or wrong, whether it makes sense or not, you know, security wins. So, you know, we're living in a world where common sense, where, you know, balanced reasoning, where doing what's right tends not to win over fear, over paranoia, over security. So the dialogue's terrible.
So the National Research Council is exploring ways to institutionalize this dialogue so that people with the proper security clearances can get together and discuss sensitive issues. But in your book, Beyond Fear, you've talked about an interesting phenomenon which often happens in security policymaking, which is security theater, where these institutions or these bureaucracies can often want to look like they're doing good things for security. Do you think that that is a problem for the institutionalization of this dialogue, or that it can cause ulterior agendas masquerading as simply a security agenda?
Yeah, it could. So security theater is what I define as security that doesn't do anything but looks good. So a lot of airport security is a great example. Right? It doesn't actually make us safer, but it looks like we're doing something. And the fear is when policymakers try to do things in security, they have a predilection towards security theater because it makes it look like they're doing something to the public, to their constituents, to whomever. So there is this natural draw towards security theater, towards security measures that make a big press splash, right, because they look good. And now the fear is, in a dialogue between the scientists and the security community, that both sides will be drawn towards security theater. Mm-hmm. I don't think that's much of a risk, or if it is, the value of the dialogue is much greater. Because remember, the scientists have a different agenda. Right? Their agenda is amassing human knowledge, is progress, is openness. So they will have a predilection towards openness and not a predilection towards secrecy. So they're going to look at security theater in the same way I do as a researcher, with derision, rather than looking at it as a way of reassuring the public that something is being done, even though it might not be effective. So I don't think there's a big risk. And if there is, the value of an institutionalized dialogue here, I think, is enormous.
Okay. I think that's about it.
Okay. Well, thank you
very much for speaking with us.
No problem.
This was Jonathan Pfeiffer for Science Progress speaking with Bruce Schneier. Edited transcripts of all Science Progress interviews are available on our website.